informal talk about my journey from undergrad to today. And then at the end, I have compiled a bunch of links that should be helpful for math majors. Okay. So I grew up in Hollow Rock, Tennessee. On the farm, my parents still have the farm, and we grow cotton and corn and soybeans in that area of the country. And the town that I'm from, Hollow Rock, is named after that rock over there that is, by legend, a meteor that fell some time ago, and it's hollow. And then I went to the University of the South on top of a mountain in Middle Tennessee, in Suwanee, Tennessee. And that's where I got my undergraduate degree in mathematics, and I also earned secondary certification. And after graduating, I taught high school math for 4 years before I went back to college. So I taught back in West Tennessee. And then I first went to the University of South Alabama. I had an older brother-in-law and sister who were doing their residencies and had a child and needed some help with that child, but I also began a master's program. I was there, did a master's in math. But while I was at South Alabama, taking a journal club class, where all the math grad students would pick an article from a journal to present to each other and share, I read one about DNA topology. And so it was this blend of math, and physics, and biology, and chemistry. And as an undergrad, I had taken math, physics, biology, chemistry, because I was tossing up between whether I was going to major in a science or a math. So this seemed like something that I was very interested in. But the only person in the world that was a mathematician studying at that time was DeWitt Summers at Florida State. So I emailed him and said, hey, I read this paper. I told him what I really liked about it and what I was interested in. He said, come visit. So I ended up doing my doctorate at Florida State University under DeWitt Summers. So that was in Tallahassee, Florida. And over my time there, they had one of the first biomedical mathematics programs, an interdisciplinary program. There are several around the U.S. nowadays. And so I completed a master's and my doctorate under DeWitt Summers at Florida State. But I was doing a very interdisciplinary program. I did first what all the pure math grad students do, and took all the pure math doctoral preliminary exams and the advanced topics exam. So the first thing you do in the first 2 years of grad school is a lot like undergrad. You take a lot more courses, the graduate level courses. And then if you're ready after those first couple of years, then you take written extensive exams across the major branches of math. And then if you do well on that, then you're ready to start taking an area of research, let's say. And after you studied it in that area for a little while, usually there's a two-part exam. One is called the Advanced Topics Exam, or something similar to that, you know, where you go, where you have to demonstrate that you know enough about the area that you think you're going to do research in to actually do some research in that area. So you have to put together your committee, and you have to present orally to them the background that you've gained in this area and your proposed research project. And so you have to demonstrate you have enough knowledge in this area to begin to do research, that you have a question or questions that you're going to look at that are novel, and that you have demonstrated you might have some capacity to address those questions. And then once you pass that, then you're somewhat free. You don't have to take coursework anymore if you wanted to, but you're free to just focus solely on your area of research then. And that continues until you have compiled enough novel data and analysis of that data to put together a dissertation and defend it to the committee. So the second half of grad school is an indeterminate amount of time. There's somewhat freedom, but you have to be driven both by the love of what you're studying and by some desire to finish. And you have to, you know, be very self-determined and disciplined to accomplish that latter half. So I was working in this interdisciplinary area at this point, and I ended up visiting a lab at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston and doing lab work and studying the DNA nodding there. And I was there 5 years before I came to UT Austin. And I first came here in the fall of 2007, working as a postdoc, and then ended up staying on. So I am in this building. I'm two-thirds teaching, a third advising, so my office is on the Love Program 150, but I also do advising on the ground floor in the advising office. For math majors, over your time here, is anyone a freshman? No. Okay, so all of you are in a prior catalog. And so in the prior catalogs, in the prior catalogs, you've got to choose an option in math. And so how many are stats? Anyone in here chose the stats? Probably Dan Nelson. Okay. How about a pure math? How many are pure math? How many are applied math? Psycom. And actuary. And you are, what did I not?
I'm a graduate.
You're a grad already. Yeah, that's right. So, all right. Did I name everybody's option over here? Anyone not a math major today? Just anyone? No. Okay. So we've had these options for a little bit of time now. With the new catalog, we went to one bachelor's of science in math. There's still the option of the BA or the BSA or the UTeach or the actuary, but one bachelor's of science in math where they could still focus in those areas, but it won't actually be differentiation in their degrees. So, and undergrad, I was just math, pure math, and started grad school, just pure math, really. But I ended up in this interdisciplinary program in biomedical mathematics. So I did everything the pure math grad students did, and then I also took graduate level biochemistry courses and genetics courses, and ended up in that lab at Baylor for 5 years doing research. I was only mathematician in the lab. However, Baylor in Houston, hopefully UT has the potential to become somewhat similar. Baylor sits right in the middle of med center, the largest medical center in the world. And there's Rice, and there's U of H, and there's UTMD, and there's various med schools and graduate schools right around them. And they have interdisciplinary and institutional graduate programs there. So there were other folks in my lab who were in similar programs that were a blend of math, biophysics, biochemistry. But I was the only one who had a pure math background. So what happens if you're a mathematician hanging around labs, then anybody that needs to analyze their data or get any statistics done, they come to you. So that you can always just hang around labs and find some little side projects to take on because they are sorely in need of mathematicians. But it was also very interesting because it was in a lab that did study topoisomerases and but they studied it from all different angles. So I was looking at the actual geometry and topology of the DNA and the proteins that interacted with the DNA and how they interacted and the results of those and the implications of a lot. But there were people who were looking at bacterial samples that came in from the hospitals and the med center where the bacteria were resistant to many of the mainstream drugs. And also, we had the cancer institutes around us. And a lot of the cancer drugs also target the topoisomerases. So there were people that were also looking at this problem from the point of view of the patients and the illnesses they got and the way that we needed to develop new drugs that would target actually the enzyme that worked on the topology that I was studying. And then there were people that were studying the structure of the topoisomerases because many of the topoisomerases, we still don't have them in full crystal structures. And so there were all these different aspects of a big, complex problem, but there were different people from this in the lab studying it from the molecular biology side, the virology side, the crystal structure, you know, all different viewpoints of the problem. And I was doing one small part, but it was very interesting to be there in that lab where my colleagues were working on the similar problem from all these different angles. So it was a big puzzle, and you could be part of that puzzle and find your niche and how you might fit into it, whatever problem it might be. Okay, so here we are. As I mentioned, started out in Tennessee. That's my Tennessee flag over there. And there are three major geographical regions to Tennessee. Tennessee's far smaller than the big state of Texas, but still interesting. We're long east to west. And it does take about as long as it takes to drive from here to Amarillo to drive from the east side to the west side of Tennessee. Not too long to drive north and south, but east to west. So there's the west side, which is bordered by the Mississippi River and is valleys, small hills, mostly valleys, great fertile farmland. That's called, so you refer to that as West Tennessee. So when someone says, like I did earlier, I'm from West Tennessee, we say that really because it is very distinct from the other two parts, which the middle is Middle Tennessee, and there are plateaus, and where I went to undergrad was on top of one of those. And then as you move to East Tennessee, you have the Smoky Mountains, so it's mountainous. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the three geographical regions of Tennessee and the stars and the state flag. Okay, this here is I'll talk a little more about my research in a moment. This is actually an electron micrograph image of a knotted DNA molecule. And there we are last fall at Dillon, Texas. Okay. So this is a quote from a paper by Dr. Neil Osroff, who is a biochemist at Vanderbilt University. And so this was a paper that came out. This is a paper that came out shortly after I completed my doctorate degree, and which he indeed said topology affects virtually every nucleic acid process that requires the double helix to be opened or moved within the cell. And by topology, Dr. Osroff does mean our kind of topology. You have to be careful when you're reading biochemistry or biology papers. Some people, and it's more physics, I would say, will indeed say topology when they don't quite mean topology. Most of the time that means geometry, because they don't know what you're talking about. But indeed, Dr. Osroff is one who's in the know. There's a community of these biochemists, biophysics, who do collaborate with mathematicians enough to know what's going on. And I brought cookies, you guys can pass around to try to So, nonetheless, there are only about three biochemists or so in the world that would use such a quote and really know what they're meaning. Oh, I didn't turn my thing on. I just remembered that.
Oh, no, it was on. I already put it on.
Okay. When I get to it. So we'll get into a little bit of my research now. I think there was supposed to be occurrences, consequences, and resolutions there. All right, so to appreciate the problem and why there might be one, here's an example of the entire amount of DNA contained within a single E. coli. Cell. So the whole E. coli genome is 4.6 times 10 to the 6 base pairs. Okay, so that's a lot. And it must be packaged within a cell that, in proportion to the DNA, is roughly that size, with that blue oval in the middle. This amount of DNA has been spilled out of a cell that was about that size in proportion. And our genome is 3.3 times 10 to the 9th base pairs, so three orders of magnitude greater in length, total length of DNA. So packaging the cell alone presents all these geometric topological problems. But then the DNA is not really just packaged or jammed in the cells. It's constantly must be accessed by proteins that are reading it, right? And manipulating it and building and doing a lot of other things with it. So there are three topological forms of DNA that we could say. So there's supercoiled DNA, which comes from, if you have the double-stranded DNA, the two strands, you know, are twisted about each other with a complete turn about every 10 and a half base pairs. But then, to package it within the cell, the DNA gets twisted, and if you look at even just this microfilm cord, as I start twisting it, notice it begins to coil about itself, right? That's what supercoiling is. It's a coil about another coil. So where my black line right now is, you imagine you've got the two strands of DNA already in around, but as you add additional coiling to another level over that, that's what supercoiling is. So there's a certain degree of supercoiling that is desired within cells, because as soon as I start coiling this up, you see it packages itself in a much tighter space, right? So that's beneficial to help package the cell, the DNA within the cell, and also to somewhat protect it from breakage and other things. A certain level of coiling is desired, but it's constantly changing as proteins access the DNA, and so it must be returned to the desirable level. Okay. So this is advantageous. The other two diagrams are photographs I have up here are not advantageous necessarily. This is a knotted double-strand DNA molecule, and these are two DNA molecules that are linked together in a manner. Okay. This would cause various problems for the cells and must be resolved when it happens. This actually can be tolerated a little bit longer than the knots within the cells because they're two separate molecules and they're not attached to each other. I mean, this one isn't even knotted. So this one, you can proceed through a few rounds of replication even before things got too crowded and blockages occurred. But the knot, because proteins are constantly accessing the DNA and pulling on it, it's under stress and different forces. Knots often get pulled tight and often lead to breakage, and that can be fatal to cells, or lots of other things can happen. But eventually, both knots and catenated or linked DNA is bad for cells. So it has to be resolved. Fortunately, every cell of every organism that we have ever studied has an enzyme that takes care of this. And this class of enzymes gets its name from topology. Yes, sir.
Sorry, I don't know if this is a silly question, but does DNA always exist in like a closed loop?
No. DNA doesn't always exist in a closed loop, but it never exists in a long, free, linear piece with ends that could come back through and resolve knots. It's always organized in loops that are adhered to different protein complexes. So it's not as easy as if we had a string with free ends and we could physically hold onto it and unknot it. That's not really going to happen even with linear chromosomes because the ends are never free to really pass through the whole molecule. So you can almost treat them all as if they are closed loops. Anything that has to happen to resolve a knot, even if it wasn't a long linear knot, that you have to resolve it locally. So it's almost like you encapsulate the knotted region in the sphere. Any resolution is going to have to happen within that local region. Good question. Yes.
If they mostly exist in that point of loop, then why do I heard that some of these strands of DNA always end up with a little end that kind of responsible for aging every time it's otherwise.
The very end of your chromosomes are called the telomeres, yes. And to some extent, the DNA contained in that region is a bit extra DNA, you might say. And so if breakages occur at the end, you're not losing essential DNA, let's say. So that's as they say that's implicated in aging. So as you lose the DNA within that region, then you're losing the DNA that somewhat is inessential and getting closer and closer to the essential DNA. So as you if you lose all the DNA within the telomere region, which you might, if you live a long time, for some of your chromosomes, let's say, then whatever DNA is that you start getting into at the later in life, if you lose some of that DNA that might be encoding for an essential gene, that can lead to different effects. Okay, so these three forms of DNA, one enzyme handles it, one class of enzymes. This class of enzymes gets their name from topology because they do indeed maintain the appropriate topology of DNA within the cells. They're called topoisomerases. From topology. Isomer. Isomers of DNA would be DNA with the same genetic sequence but different topology. And ACE, anything that is an ACE is an enzyme. Let's make sure this grows on the board. here's another series of microscopic images of different levels of supercoin. The one on the far left is pretty much an open, relaxed, circular DNA, and then there's more and more coiling as you move to the right. So this one is very tightly supercoiled. It's almost like a straight rod in the center, but then you see those loops at the end. If it was circular DNA, that's what you would see with a high level of supercoiling. And DNA net, let's talk more about that. So there are lots of things that happen all the time in cells that contribute to DNA knotting. Just compacting it within the cells alone, crowding this long molecule that's constantly being opened and closed by proteins for various reasons, could lead to knotting in the DNA. The topoisomerase reactions themselves, what this enzyme does is the type 2 topoisomerase binds to double-stranded DNA. They literally break the double-stranded DNA. The protein holds onto the two broken ends, allows another region of the DNA to pass through that break, and then they religate it, and then they release the DNA. So because for a moment they're breaking and rejoining DNA, it's possible that they could misbreak it in a place and rejoin it where it would cause a knot. Replication, of course, certainly leads to the catenanes frequently. If you do have close circular DNA, the first thing you do when you're replicating, you might know, you see those pictures in your book, your biology books, where you've got a replication bubble, so to speak, and you start replicating. So you breathe apart the two strands and start replicating each of those. Some men are like this, roughly. So if you continue doing this all the way around, the thing we're not seeing in the replication bubble picture is that they're supercoiling to this side, and they're supercoiling to this side of that replication fork. So as it proceeding, the enzymes are removing the supercoils ahead, the topoisomerases are, and they're reintroducing them behind, but there are times that that doesn't get perfectly done by the time replication proceeds all the way around, and that's where you get the linked DNA molecules. Okay. And then sometimes, because of the high level of supercoiling, the strands, when they collide, they do sometimes break and rejoin. There are many mechanisms within all cells to recognize broken DNA and fix it, repair it, put it back together as soon as possible if they find anything around that's complementary and that gets good. If not, then there are mechanisms in all of our cells to degrade that DNA, because if they can't find complementary DNA around that, it must be foreign DNA. That's what our cells are programmed to think. It must be a virus. So we chew it up and degrade that whole strand of DNA. If that happened to have been low rRNA that we had gotten tied in a knot, and the knot had been pulled tight and broken the DNA, and then our cells could fix it and they degraded that strand, well, that could be fatal. But any of the normal operations in which protein complexes access the DNA and break it and rejoin it, any of those could potentially lead to knots, and under certain circumstances, do.
I have a question.
Yes.
All of these processes seem to be not healed. DNA knotting seems to be like a side effect.
Yes.
So is there like any like intentional like knotting or coiling?
There's certainly intentional coiling, the super coiling, but as far as we know, there's not any knotting that cells do for a beneficial purpose. None of our cells, there are bacteriophages, DNA that are in circumstances is knotted. But our DNA, it would never be healthy that we know of so far for any of the DNA in our cells to be knotted. We know it does happen, and we know that these enzymes in a healthy cell resolve it immediately in picoseconds of time, these enzymes out. And these enzymes are expressed in high amounts during all of these processes, especially during replication. So they're there, they're present in our cells at the times that they're needed, as long as we have healthy cells. And as long as you're not taking a fluoroquinolone antibiotic that might be targeting this, or a cancer drug, many of the anti-cancer drugs target these enzymes. The reason why so many drugs, from drugs to fight bacteria to fight cancer, target these enzymes is because of what I described earlier about their normal action with DNA. the topoisomerases combine to DNA and break it. And so in picoseconds of time, they bind, break, pass through, religate, release in normal healthy cell. They do that in picoseconds. However, if the drugs target these enzymes at the point at which they've broken the DNA and bind and prevent it from religating, it can lead to breaks in DNA. So that's a great way to kill bacteria and a great way to kill cancer cells. Prevent the bacteria from putting their DNA back together. Even every type of bacteria we've studied, bacteria from geysers, bacteria that cause strep throat, every organism we have ever studied has this enzyme. So that's one reason why so many drugs target this type of enzyme. Because of that breakage and because we know every cell of every organism has such an enzyme. Unfortunately, yes, that has happened. Sometimes when children have been treated for cancer, like childhood leukemia or something, later in life, age 40, 50, a different type of cancer occurs. And sometimes it is because they have linked it, because the first cancer treatment did do harm to some of the healthy cells. So there are it's an ever-emerging area of research for biochemists to continue drugs. To get more targeted drugs that will target either strictly bacterial or strictly cancer cells.
How do these actually detect if there is like knotting in the DNA? Because like, are knots hard to like distinguish from the unknot?
That's a great question. How do they? We have all these different mathematical means of differentiating between the unknot and knots. But how do the cells do that? How does this enzyme do it? So that was an aspect of what we had studied. There are various types of knots, and there are some knots that are known as twist knots So twist knots have if you draw them in their most ideal conformation, they have a twisted region that looks like supercoils, and then they have a clasp region that has two crossings that looks like a clasp of a necklace would look, okay? Now, if we were to look at them in their ideal conformation, it would be very obvious that some of those crossings are just from supercoils, which we like these type of crossings. But then the clasp probably comes from when you have a highly supercoiled molecule, you end up with these loops at the end. And so if two of those loops join together, you'd get a clasp region with two crossings. And so right away, when we look at supercoiled crossings versus those clasps, the geometry does look different. And actually, twist knots are the most frequently occurring ones in biological organisms. So it probably very well is a combination of geometry and topology that is driving these enzymes to where they act. You might know, remember a little from your biology, that there are certain enzymes that are called site-specific, that they go to certain strings of DNA, like AATCG or something, and they only act on those that region. That's not true for topoisomerases. They're not site-specific enzymes. So it's not the sequence of the DNA that they go to. It is something else. So what else might it be? It probably is the geometry and topology of the DNA when it's in a supercoiled crossing versus when it's in a knot. So back to those twist knots. When they have the twisted region and the clasped region, every twist knot, whatever number of crossings it might have, has a knotting of a 1. Because all you have to do is change one crossing in that clasped region, and the whole thing unknots. And if you just change one crossing in that clasped region, you'd leave all those supercoiled crossings in the molecule. So if we're talking about a DNA knot, the supercoil is desirable, right? The knotting part isn't. But the supercoiled region is desirable. So you would hope that these enzymes would have some mechanism of differentiating between crossings that were contributed from supercoils versus ones that are really trapping it into a knotted conformation. It seems that they do, actually. These are just various more electron micrograph images of DNA. You can tell which is the micrograph image and which is a hand-drawn version trying to sniff it out. Those are links or catenanes. get more to your question, I was going to see how much more I have. Yeah, let's talk about this. Okay, so there are various things that happen. So I looked at what happens when the knots aren't resolved, and then I tried to look at how they are resolved and what the enzymes be affected. So first of all, what I found when I, in E. coli cells, that I had them take up plasmid DNA, that I could control whether it knotted itself or not. I could turn it on by the addition of some, by the addition of some drugs to the media in which I was growing the E. coli. And I could grow them for some time, and I could block the E. coli's topoisomerases, so I could make the plasmids inside the bacteria knot, and then I could turn off, so to speak, the enzyme that could resolve those knots, and then make a lot of knots accumulate and see what goes wrong. So in very brief, simplified terms, that's what I was doing in the experiments. And we found that knots were inhibiting the function of genes. If I made a knot in a plasmid molecule that contains, say, an antibiotic-resistant gene, then that gene was no longer being transcribed. The cells were no longer replicating that plasmid. Lots of things were growing wrong. And the cells were dying. When I did put them in the presence of the antibiotic, which indicated they weren't able to transcribe all that knotted plasmid. But what I would do would be plate these DNA out and then put some antibody in the center. And I'd see a big kill zone around this antibody. They should have been, the E. coli had a plasmid that encoded for this antibiotic resistance. So if I didn't turn on 9, they would live and they could dissolve this antibody. If I turned on the knotting and plated them, put the antibiotic on there, they were dying in a big kill zone around this antibiotic because they could no longer transcribe that antibiotic resistance off the knotted plasmid. However, within that kill zone, and I don't think I put a picture of that in here, but it really did look like a kill zone, but then suddenly, there were, if you let them grow a few days, there were some colonies that popped up in that kill zone. So then we studied those. We can lift them back off the plate and grow those up and see what's going on in those cells. What we found out, in those cells, their DNA was completely rearranged from the original DNA that the original E. coli strain had. So what happened? Well, most likely what happened, when we can look at the sequence of the DNA and somewhat figure this puzzle out of what happened, the knots did break the DNA usually. And then, as I mentioned earlier, every cell has mechanisms to recognize broken DNA. And they do one of two things to it. If they grab the broken DNA, try to find something that fits and complementing, put it back together. If they can't, then they degrade it. Most of the time, they could not, and they degraded it, and the cells died. But sometimes, they were putting the plasmid DNA in a different rearrangement. There were actually two plasmids in each of these E. coli. Sometimes they connected those two plasmids together. So both they had got knotted, and then trying to repair the knot, they had fused the two different plasmids together, and it actually gave these bacteria a greater level of resistance to the antibiotic. One plasmid that had the antibiotic-resistant gene had a moderate promoter on it. The other plasmid that it ended up being fused to had a promoter that expressed, made it, when they were put together, basically made it express more of the antibiotic-resistant gene. So these bacteria had higher level of resistance. And so knotting was literally driving evolution in these particular cells. On a larger scale, who knows? Maybe it does. But in those cells, it definitely was. But it also is back to the instability in genomes that can result from chemotherapy. Probably interfering with the topoisomerases caused knotting, and it either is lethal or it can promote rearrangement, which could lead to this genomic instability we've seen after cancer treatments. The topoisomerases, as I mentioned, they can maintain the proper level of supercholine. These knots, we've just seen ways they are very bad for cells. They can resolve the knots or the catenase. And their reactions go both ways. They can take relaxed DNA, which happens at times for various reasons, and reintroduce supergrowth, or they can remove the supergrowth. They can catenate or unlink, and they can knot or unknot. Okay. And then to appreciate their role all the more, this slide is electron micrograph images where the stringy stuff is a DNA molecule and the dark blob is a single topoisomerase chimerase bound to the DNA. So they're relatively small enzymes in proportion to the DNA molecule they have to act on. So you don't want them to sit there and have to read the whole DNA molecule and run around it. We know they don't, because as I mentioned, we know that they act in picoseconds of time. So they're not reading the sequence. They're not assessing the entire geometry topology of the knot. It must be more I feel like when the topology of a knot exists in the DNA molecule, then the knot crossings, there's always forces. There's always other proteins trying to access the DNA molecule and bound to it in different places and literally pulling on it. So if you had a knot in something like this and you started pulling, the knot's going to get pulled tight. And therefore, the knot crossings are going to be more prominent. Their geometry is going to be more prominent. So I think the topology of being in a knot forces geometry in the crossings where you want the topo to actually act. And it's the geometry of the knot crossings that the enzyme is probably bound to. And we know in all of these places where it's bound at a place where it's almost a 90-degree angle between the two pieces of DNA. So that certainly is likely to happen in catenin. And then the clasp of the twist knot. So that's reasonable. And on the other side is a German painting titled Notenloser, and she loosens knots, which is what topoisomerase does in the cells. Yes, sir?
So what is the origin of these enzymes? Like, how were they synthesized in the first place?
How were they synthesized? By humans or by...
By the DNA.
That no one knows that for sure how they were originally made, but they're encoded within the chromosomes of every organism we've ever studied. Which came first? Which came first? The enzyme that's essential for life, or the genome that encodes life? I don't know. But I'm not sure I quite understood your question, but we didn't create these.
No.
But when did we first discover them? Jim Wong, who was at Harvard and retired just recently, in the 60s, I want to say, and I may have that date wrong, but it is certainly not wrong by very much. But I think Jim Wong in the 60s first, he discovered something he called the omega protein that he noticed was that there was a protein present that was manipulating the DNA in this manner. But there's still a lot of unanswered open questions. No, that wouldn't have been possible. What we see them already acting in picoseconds, they were already expressed. So, who knows at what point in evolution this occurred, but apparently cells now produce these in excess amounts just prior to replication. And if you spill open a cell at the point of replication, you'll see plenty of these enzymes present. So cells at this point produce these when they need them. And they're just, it has to be the case that the enzyme is sitting there ready to act, because the knot happens real quick and it's resolved in picoseconds of time. If it's not, then it's fatal or it causes rearrangements. So in all healthy cells, this happens so fast that the enzymes must already be there ready to act. Okay, so that was about all I was going to really talk about that, but we can talk more about that later. Just for fun, Valentine's Day, here's this article that dark chocolate could be good for you, could enhance your mathematical ability. So go home today and eat some dark chocolate. And here's a little Sapinski triangle version of this. And then have put together this list of information which wanted to do some time. And I just went through all my links and made sure these are all current active ones. So you've probably seen most all of this information, but there may be some of it that's new for you. Okay, so our Math, Physics, and Astronomy Advising Center is on the ground floor of this building. It's a great resource for you. The three ladies that are professional academic advisors down there are Susan Brown, Rhonda Hall, Christina Graves, and they are full-time. Probably each of you have one of them you're assigned to that you see, and they can answer anything you have, any question you have about your UT Austin degree and your degree plan, and how far you are to graduate, and all that sort of stuff. If you have a math course specific question, then I could be your resource, or Dr. Maxwell or Alyssa Walsh if you're actuary, or Dr. Mark Daniels if you're UTeach, or Dr. Todd Arbogast if you're PsyComp. But if you're any of the other flavors of math, then feel free to ask me, or make an appointment to see me, catch me sometime. And it's a thing I encourage all of you to do. How many have or are participating in the directed reading program? Okay, great. We have both the mentors and mentees. Okay, that's an excellent opportunity that is just a few years old.
The ERP.
Okay.
Five or six.
It wasn't here when I first gave it. I've been here 10 years, but it wasn't here when I first gave it. Anyhow, great program that connects you as an undergrad with graduate students or postdocs or faculty, and you begin to do something outside of your courses. Some of you, depending on how far along you are, you're doing independent research, but some of you are just doing independent study initially, and it's a great opportunity to flip the door towards that. If you want to review what the math department has available to you about our math major options, there's that one. Then I strongly encourage you as undergrads to go ahead and connect with the major mathematical professional societies. And so they are SIAM, AMS, MAA are the three major ones. And each of them have a page, their website, that's dedicated to students predominantly. And they have tons of information there, okay, about what you should do now as an undergrad, internships, long-term jobs, is grad school right for me or not. They really are better than anything I've compiled here. So do read over all three of those. Even if you're pure math, read over and look at all three of those, okay? Then set some that are a little more specific to perhaps particular interest or the Society for Mathematical Biology, SMB, the Society for Actuaries. And then next I linked to some institutes. There are, I think, 8 institutes in the U.S. that are funded by the math institutes that are funded by the NSF, and you can find those if you follow that link. That's a good resource to see what kind of research are people doing. Each of those institutes probably have summer programs. Long term, some of them have grad school funding and grad school opportunities, so look over that. Then there's also this National Institute for Mathematical Biological Synthesis, which is also relatively new and one to look at. So those are the institutes. Okay, and then I've just a few links about what you might do as a mathematician. So there's some sites. The MAA's career site gives you some various profiles across all areas of math, people doing math, what they do in their job. This is a nice one, I think, as you're taking your proofwriting courses. This is maybe a nice reference to look over the nuts and bolts of writing math. And then job search sites.
Mom,
so
are you calling
I put on there, first of all, the CNS Career Services website. They've got tons of information there, and they are a great resource on campus for you. They have a job database called Handshake. Who has not heard of Handshake? Okay, good thing I'm for a few minutes. You're a UT student, right? Okay, Handshake is another thing that's come out since I've been here.
Can I talk to you? How am I going to see my things in there?
Okay. So Handshake, they have long-term jobs and summer internships in that database across all branches of science, but still you should look and consider it. And then, of course, in our department, we need graders and learning assistants, okay? So those are work-study type jobs you can think about while you're an undergrad. I happen to know next fall we're going to be able to hire a few more learning. This is this fall 2017. So keep that in mind. Practical experience for you. And then there the next four, let's say, are just various things across the web that I think I have read somewhat recently and thought might be interesting, might be helpful. So you might read over those. This one that says five tips to get the teaching job you want. I thought, as I read it, I was thinking, well, these are great tips for anybody. And I've only bookmarked these four random ones. So I don't just bookmark anything. So look over that. That I thought was kind of a nice one. But all of them had something I thought was good. All right, throw them in. Then, next up, I have various summer opportunities I've asked. So how many have heard of REUs, Research Experiences for Undergrads? Okay. So a lot of our undergrads get to do REUs. So I encourage you to apply. Some of the deadlines are now and vastly disappearing for this summer. But check it out. So these are programs funded by the National Science Foundation, and they're offered at universities all over the U.S. And they're short summer opportunities where you'll probably get a stipend and room and board, and you'll work in a group on a specific project that the faculty at that university have put together for you that summer, where you will actually get some work research done. Some of our math majors end up being chosen for an REU and then bringing that project back into your team and continuing it, maybe to become a honors thesis or something. What I encourage people to do when they're thinking about REUs are be very open-minded. When you go to grad school, you're going to think, where am I going to want to live? Am I going to, do I have a faculty member there that's doing something I'm interested in and all? You're going to think of a whole lot of things. When you think of an REU, think of cover up the name of the university. When you go to the site, the university's first, and over to the right is the topic. Look at the column at the right. Look at the topic. Find anything that interests you, five or six, and apply to them. Don't even give a second thought to where it is. You want to have a graduate degree from a reputable place, and a place where you feel like you can live for whoever knows how many years. There are lots of considerations you have to weigh when you're picking a grad school.
Mommy?
Don't be so overburdened when you're picking
an
REU. Because all of the schools have things that are funded by the National Science Foundation. And so they're all valuable programs. Okay? So be open-minded. That's my main point there. But there are a few other institutes or things across the U.S. that I've listed here that have summer programs for undergraduates. So this, yes, sir.
As an international student,
some of these are very limited. The REUs are limited. I would look at down the other ones that are not necessarily REUs.
International research.
And that one, some of those aren't even in the U.S. Well, but yeah, look at those. And if you look at particular institutes, some of those are not just narrow, but yeah, the REUs are very kind of U.S. students. That's a good question. I didn't particularly look for that, but I could do that for you, Paul, as long as I get back to you. So these are some that are all over the U.S., and you might check out. Some of those, if I check this, you have not missed it. And then the last topic, I got two more topics here, but this, I have sustainability. So I mentioned that I was saying something about work-life balance. Well, so there's some links there. Basically, don't go to grad school unless you're passionate and you really want to learn more and more and more. And you won't survive grad school unless you find a topic that you really are interested in and that drives you and pulls you along. Do you think that's true?
Yeah.
Certainly was true for me. If I was not fully interested and invested in this and curious about this, I would not have survived. Being in the lab part of the time would have been very
different.
It is a hierarchical, competitive structure within any lab you might end up in. But the main thing that will be a challenge if you do consider grad school is the indeterminate amount of time that you're giving to the this endeavor. Now, the end goal you want, but there's this indeterminate amount of time. It's hard to make a commitment to anything other than your work, and so you have to be prepared to do that. But you also have to be prepared to find ways to balance what you're doing. So, for me, I would not have survived if I went to grad school in the far north, and there were cold, long winters. And that was just a reality of me. And so some of you might not be able to survive a grad school here, or it's hot for so long. I don't know. But for me, I couldn't survive intense cold. Because my release and my reset and refresh is getting outside and doing things outside. So I encourage you to find something that helps you balance your life. There's a couple of sites here that I thought you might even look over that UT directs faculty to about a work-life balance. Some of the information there I think even you would find helpful. I know there's tons of resources for students too. But also, when you are deciding grad school or later jobs, you might compare what they're offering to what UT offers back here in kind of way, okay? Or you might even have ideas to bring to your own institutions later about what could be there to help. And then the last little bit, I threw in some links about math and games. So certainly another endeavor I think that actually for me helps balance everything is doing math outreach. So I get involved with when CNS has the family day in the fall. What do we call it family day? Or there's a weekend, this family weekend where we have a math table and we spell out games. And then coming up very soon, the first Saturday in March, is the entire university has the Explore UT, which is a grand, giant open house for the whole university. And we have kids from toddlers through grandparents on campus. And I think we have 50,000 people on campus last year, but we have like double our normal on campus people. We have tons of people that day. And so I think being able to be ambassadors for our subject to the greater world, whether it's just with your friends in other majors or your family members, or it is volunteering in events such as that, we need that voice in the community. I'll try not to quote myself, fight my time. But we need to let people know that we do more than just rote calculation and we don't spill out memorized formulas all the time. There's a lot of creative work that we do, and a lot of that creative work can be fostered through games from a young age up, right? I bet some of you have some favorite games. One of my favorite toys as a child was Tinker Toys. And I think all that spatial reasoning that you develop. My sisters and I love to create huge contraptions. What are some of your favorite games that you play now or that you remember playing as a child? What? Puggle?
Puggle? It's you shape letters.
Oh, bobbles. Yes?
Bagels come?
Bagels?
Lego,
yes, certainly Legos. Yes? What else? How many play set? No. Okay. Have you heard of the game set?
Yeah,
the attributes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a lot of the mathematics behind that. That is one. And then this is kind of an interesting one from a few years ago, but it throws in their strategies for chess and various other things. Okay, questions, comments? Yes, sir.
If I want to go to graduate school as a statistics student major, so if pure math is a good choice in a undergraduate.
Yes, and if you're going to grad school statistics, you know, you definitely want to take some analysis as an undergrad. And then here on campus, we have the statistics department that's also just a few years old. They no longer have undergraduate degrees yet, but they offer those two certifications. You could complement your math degree with one of their certifications. And then even statistics has all these various branches that you could go into, right? And so we have people in the department that work in different flavors, completely different flavors of statistics. So
do we have a statistic graduate student in UT?
Yes, that statistics department only has graduate students right now. They don't have any graduate students. So our statistics department has some grad students. We have some math students that are, well, even I end up using statistics. We did computer simulations of confirmations, and I had to do statistical analysis upon that. Anybody that ends up working with a little bit of data at all in the research will have to do some statistics, but then the degree of it certainly varies. But